Pacifica owned and listener supported for over 50 years. This is 90.1 KPFT and FM HD1 Houston.
That is the percolating beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees. That means it's 5 p.m. on a Thursday and time for So What's Your Story? We're the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to stories and the art of telling them, right here on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston's community radio. Well, I'm your host today, Eric Heen, and I'm backed up by the most talented team on radio. And here on So What's Your Story, we feature guests every week who'll take us on magical journeys through their imaginations before landing us safely back into the present. Well, our guest today is Mr. Richard Martin. Richard grew up in England, but now makes his home in Germany. Richard's been telling professionally throughout the world for over 30 years. He has more than 300 stories in his repertoire, most of which are folk tales that reflect the full range of human experience. Hey, Richard, it's great to have you here on So What's Your Story?
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Richard, you're obviously a very accomplished at telling stories. When did you first realize that you were destined to be a storyteller?
It was quite by chance, like most things in my life. My wife was working in a school as a teacher, talking to another teacher who had a group of kids playing old instruments, you know, these shawms and sackbuts, really difficult things to blow down. And he was saying, my poor kids, it's difficult in a concert. They really need something in between the bits of music so they have time to recover. And my wife said, well, ask Richard. I'm sure he'd come tell a few stories. Well, I've never done anything like that before, but there I was. And my first performance, there were 130 people in the audience, I seem to remember. And my goodness, it was magical, as you storytellers listeners know. And after that, I never looked back.
Apparently it was meant to be. Your wife got you into it.
That's right. I had so many things in my life. I'll put it down to my wife.
I can relate, Richard. Well, we heard how you got into storytelling. Why don't we get to your stories? Let's hear your first one.
Okay. Well, because I live in Germany, I thought it'd be good to begin with a tale from the Brothers Grimm. And it's a story which begins as so many of theirs did. Once upon a time. And once upon a time, there was a young man. Now, if you ever heard a fairy tale in which there is a young man, you can be pretty sure that that young man is very, very poor. And so it was in this story. In fact, he was so poor, every morning he had to pick up his axe, swing it onto his shoulder, and go out into the forest to cut down trees. Yes, he was a woodcutter. Now, I told you he was poor. Yes, he did not have very much in his pocket. But that young man, he had plenty elsewhere. Oh, yeah, you can think about it. All that exercise, what a physique he had. Muscles everywhere. Yeah. Now, if you have ever heard a story with a poor young man, you can be pretty sure there's going to be a pretty princess. And again, so it was in this story. And one morning, the pretty princess, she was just sitting there, eating her breakfast, looking out of the castle window, looking down the road, when she saw, coming up that road, that young woodcutter. Ooh, she saw him stop in front of a tree. She saw him put down his axe, and she saw him rip off his shirt and begin to swing that axe to cut that tree. Ooh. And she looked, and she looked, and she looked. And she liked what she could see. And in fact, what she could not see, she thought she might like even more, if you understand what I mean. Now, all of you young men listening to this tale, you know how it is, don't you? If you are there with your shirts stripped off and you're swinging that axe and there's a pretty princess staring at your back, you can feel it, can't you? And so could he. Slowly, he turned around. Their eyes met. And drawn by the magnetic power of teenage love, they came closer and closer and closer together until their lips almost touched. When along came the king on a big white horse. Fathers always come at the wrong time, don't they? Oh, stop! Ernie wasn't just talking to the horse. Stop! Do you not know that any man who wants to marry my daughter must first bring me the three golden hairs from the devil's head? Now that is a pretty good condition to put down if you are a father of a teenage girl. Ooh, it gets rid of those young men. Unless the young man happens to be a woodcutter. For he just looked at her and said, "Very well. If the road to heaven must first take me through hell, then so be it. Will you wait for me?" And of course, as you in Houston know, she said, "Yes." And so, that young man, he turned and he left. And he walked down the road. And he walked and he walked and he walked. He walked so far that he came to a town. And that town, like all the towns in my story, it had a wall around it. And in the wall, there was a gate. And in front of the gate, there was a soldier, a sentry, who said, "Stop! Where are you going?" "Hey, what do you know?" "Where am I going?" "Well, I reckon I'm going to hell." "What do I know?" "Why, I know everything." "No, everything. Ooh, that's good. We need somebody like you because we have such a problem in our town. Listen, we have a well which has always given us clear, fresh water, but suddenly that well is empty. It's dry. Do you have an answer?" "I have the answers to everything. I'll tell you when I come back from hell." That young man, he turned and he walked down the road. And he walked and he walked and he walked. He walked so far that he came to a second town. And that town too had a wall around it. And in that wall there was a gate. And in front of the gate there was a soldier, a sentry, who said, "Stop! Hey, where are you going?" "And what do you know?" "Where am I going?" "Ooh, that's easy. I'm going to hell." "And what do I know?" "I know everything." "You know everything? That is so good. We need somebody like you because we have such a problem in our town. Here we have an apple tree which has always given us apples of purest solid gold, but suddenly there are no apples, there are no leaves. We think the tree is drying, it's dying. Do you have an answer?" "I know all the answers. Tell me when I come back from hell." And again, the young man, he turned And he walked down the road. And he walked and he walked. He walked so far that he came, this time, not to a town, but a river. And there on the bank of the river, there was a ferry boat drawn up, waiting to carry passengers across to the other side. And as the young man stepped in, the ferryman said, "Where are you going? And, hey, what do you know?" "Where am I going? Oh, I'm going to hell. What do I know? I know everything." "Oh," said the ferryman, as he rowed and rowed and rowed the boat across the river, "if you want to go to hell, you're going the right way about it, because it's over there on the other side. But if you know everything, but perhaps you can help me. Because you see, I've been in this boat for thousands and thousands of years, and I just cannot let go of this oar. Do you have an answer for me?" And as the boat came to the other bank and the young man got ready to jump, he said, "I know all the answers. I'll tell you when you get back from hell." And he jumped onto the other bank, and he walked and he walked and he walked down that road. And that road, why, it was a smooth road, a broad road. There were flowers growing on either side. So he knew he must be on the road to hell. And there at last he came. He came to the gates of hell, and as he knocked on the door, the gates were opened by the devil's wife. "Ooh, what do you want to know?" And as she heard him say, "I have come for the 3 golden hairs of the devil's head," she said, "Oh, my husband, he won't like that. He's not here at the moment. Gone to Houston in Texas, I believe. But why not come in?" Because the devil's wife had looked and looked and looked, and she liked what she could see. And the devil's wife thought what she could not see she might like even more. "Come in, come in. Let's come with me to the bedroom and we'll see what we can do." Now the young man, as he was led by the devil's wife to the devil's bedroom, he explained to her that it was not only the 3 golden hairs he needed 3 answers. Do you remember them? There was the first town with the well that was dry. The second town where the apple tree no longer gave apples of purest gold. And the third was the ferryman who could not let go of that oar. But all the devil's wife could think about was, "Come and sit on the bed here, here, here. Come closer and closer and closer." And as she got closer and closer to him, suddenly they heard coming down the road heavy banging footsteps. "Ooh, it's my husband back from Houston. Quick, 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 under the bed." She pushed him under the bed. Just in time for the devil came in. "I smell man's flesh. What have we got here?" "Oh, you in your man's flesh. We're in no man's flesh here. Just come and have a glass of beer." And as she always did, she gave the devil a bottle of beer to drink. Well, as he knocked it back and... And you know what beer can do to a man and a devil. And soon, as he lay down with his head in her lap, he began to snore and snore and snore. And so she could look through his hairs, and she found the first golden one. And she pulled. "Wife, what are you doing? Pulling my hair like that." "Oh," she said as she slipped that hair under the bed. "Husband, yes, I must have fallen asleep myself. I had such a strange dream, husband. I was in a town and they had a well which was dry, and they asked me to look into it to see what the problem was. And I thought I was going to fall down the well in my dream. And I must have grabbed your hair. I'm so sorry, husband."
"Oh, well,
I know that well, very well. All they've got to do is look under the stone at the bottom of the well. There's a big fat white toad. They've got to kill that, and then the well will be full of water. Now, don't you touch my hair again. No. Have another bottle of beer. Well, the devil, of course, he knocked that next bottle back and soon... she began to look once more, and she found the second whole golden hair. And she pulled, wife, what have you done again? Oh, husband, the dreams I'm having. I don't know. I thought I was in a second town. Yes, and in my dream, they had a tree which had given them golden apples, and they thought it was dying, and they asked me to climb the tree to find the problem. And in my dream, I thought I was going to fall. I must have grabbed your hair. Oh, I'm sorry, husband. Problem isn't at the top of the tree. I know it well. It's down at the bottom. There's a little white mouse gnawing the roots. All they've got to do is dig down, find the mouse, kill it, and then the tree will live again. No. Have another bottle of beer. Of course, soon the beer was drunk again, and once more she looked, once more she found, she pulled. Oh, the dreams I'm having, husband. I thought I was in a ferry boat. Yes, in my dream, the ferryman, he could not let go of the oar, and he was so unhappy that the boat banged against the bank. I thought I was going to fall. In my dream, I must have grabbed your hair. Sorry, husband.
Fool of a ferryman. All he's got to do is... tell the next passenger to put his hand on the oar, and then the ferryman can go free. Don't you touch my hand. No. And more beer.
Well, soon it was the devil was snoring, and soon it was out from under the bed, clutching the three golden hairs, came the young man. And as the devil's wife took him to the gates of hell and said a long, long, long goodbye, at last he was free and running down the road back to the river. And when he jumped into the ferry boat, the ferryman said, you've come back. Do you have an answer for me?
Of course, I've got all the answers, I told you. All you've got to do.
And the ferryman listened as he was rowing back to the other side. All you've got to do is tell the next passenger to put his hand on the oar. And of course, the young man here jumped onto the bank, and then you can go free. But the young man was already going up the road to that second town where the sentry said, come back. Hey, do you have an answer for us?
Of course, I know all the answers. All you've got to do is dig down to the roots, find the white mouse, kill it, and your tree will live.
And the townspeople, they dug, they found, and the mouse was dead and the tree full of leaves and golden apples. Oh, they said, you have saved our town. Oh, we must reward you. And a cart was brought, and that cart was laden with apples of purest gold. And so it was. The young man, he led that cart up the road to the first town, where the sentry said, come back. Did you have an answer for us?
Of course, I know all the answers. Just go down to the bottom of the well under a stone. There's a white toad. Kill it and you'll have water again.
Down they went. They found and yes, once more that well was full of the clearest, freshest water.
You have saved our town. Oh, we must reward you.
We must reward you. For look, that wagon of gold, that needs guarding. And so it was that town gave the young man soldiers armed with swords, soldiers with muskets, soldiers with cannon. And together he marched on up the road to the castle, where the princess said,
oh, you've come back. Of course, I come back. Oh, and the king says, hey, you've come back. But, and the king looked behind and saw that there was a wagon of gold. Gold, gold. And he also saw all the soldiers pointing their muskets and cannon at him. Well, very well, marry you can. But all that gold. Now, the king, he was already the king. He had plenty of gold. But you know how it is, don't you? The more gold you have, the more you want. And so it was with the king. Hey, do you know where I can get gold like that? And the young man said, yes, for I know all the answers. Just go down the road, past the two towns until you come to a river, get into the ferry boat and do all that the ferryman tells you. And off ran the king. And of course, you know, he never came back. And so it was, the poor woodcutter and the pretty princess. Yes, they married. And it's a story, really, which shows that you, even when someone tells you to go to hell, remember, you say, I have all the answers. And then perhaps you too, like them, will live happily ever after.
Yes. Great story, Richard. I love it. I love those devil stories. You say the devil was in Houston at that time.
I do not know why I suddenly thought of that.
Well, he comes here quite often.
Oh, does he? Does he? It must be the beer. It must be the beer.
Yeah, he comes to tempt us, I'd say. You know, Richard, here's a question we often ask storytellers who travel throughout the world, like you do.
Yeah.
Is storytelling at its core, is it pretty much the same thing everywhere? Is it universal? Or are there big fundamental differences between like African stories, Native American, and so forth? How is that?
Well, certainly there are regional differences. What I would say is it depends on the teller. Mm. And storytellers, we are a very differing bunch. And it's what we do with the story. At root, we tell stories because we know that those stories, they reflect something very deep in humanity, something very old in humanity, and perhaps we want to pass that on. So I would say that is a universal, the need to tell stories, and the type of stories, and perhaps also the way people tell them, that does certainly change from region to region.
Definitely.
Well, we're going to take a break from our show now for station identification and to make a few announcements. I'm Eric Keene, and you're listening to So What's Your Story on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. Our show sponsor is the Houston Storytellers Guild. The Guild puts on story swaps fourth Tuesday of every month, and everyone is invited. To find out more about them, go to HoustonStorytellers.org. And while you're there, click on So What's Your Story to find out more about our show. There you will find archive programs dating all the way back to 2008. We're also on Facebook, so go to So What's Your Story on Facebook and find out more about us there. And don't forget our friends down at the Moth Storytelling Organization. The Moth holds a monthly story slam the second Tuesday of every month, and their next slam will be on September 13th. They're at the Warehouse Live down on Emanuel Street. Doors open at 6:30 and stories begin at 7. And the theme for next month's story will be juggling. Now, it's not literally juggling. It's, you know, metaphorically, we all juggle things in our life. So if you have a story about that, go down to the Warehouse Live next September 13th and tell it at the Moth.
And now we're going to get back to our guest, Richard Martin. So Richard, you got so many stories. Let's hear another one.
This is often a story I tell, particularly where it's going to be somehow be about storytelling, because it's a tale which shows the importance of having a story to tell. And it's a story from Scotland. And if you've ever been to Scotland, you'll perhaps know that there are beautiful parties up there, a ceilidh up in the Highlands. Ceilidh, the idea that you've got to do something. Everyone who comes to a ceilidh has to contribute to the entertainment. Right. I think they say it's tell us a story, sing us a song, show us your bum, or out you've gone. You've got to do something to make everybody laugh. But long, long ago, up in the Highlands, there was a farmer and he was having a ceilidh. And the folk were there, they were drinking the whiskey and they were telling the stories. They were drinking the whiskey, they were singing the songs, they were dancing the dances. Hadn't quite got around to showing the bum yet, but they were having a good time. When suddenly the farmer turned to young Jimmy. Now, Jimmy, young lad, only just started working at the farm, and the farm said, "Hey, Jimmy, I've seen you knocking back the whiskey. All right, come, now it's your turn. Tell us a story." Well, I don't know what it's like for you, but if somebody suddenly turns to me and says, "Hey, Richard, tell us a story," all the stories that just go right out of my head. Yeah? And I'm a storyteller. Well, it's the same for Jimmy, of course. He said, "Well, I don't know any stories." "All right, then, sing us a song." "I can't sing." "All right, Jimmy, then do us a dance." "I've got two left feet." "Hey, Jimmy, we don't want to see your bum. You've got to do something or out you've gone. Now, what is it going to be?" I can't." Well, true to his word, the farmer took Jimmy by the shoulders, marched him to the door and threw him out. "You can come back when you've got a story." And slammed the door in his face. Well, poor Jimmy was out there under the full moon, feeling such a fool, because you do feel a fool, don't you, when you haven't got a story to tell. Well, he wandered down through the moonlight down to the loch. You know, the lake is called a loch up there, of course. And he was walking by the side of the loch when he came to a boat half pulled up out of the water. But it was a boat Jimmy had not seen before. Well, he looked in and in the darkness, I don't know what it was, perhaps something to do with the full moon, but in the darkness, it seemed to Jimmy as if there was something glistening, something shining. Well, he leant forward to see what it could be. And as he did lean forward, his foot must have slipped on the soft mud because he fell into the boat. He fell so hard, bang, he banged his head against the boat and he was out cold. And falling into the boat, there must have been just enough weight to push the boat out onto the water, because when Jimmy did come to, he could feel the boat rocking. He could feel the bump on his head. Oh, he wondered how big it was, and he looked over the side of the boat to see the reflection, to see how big it was, the bump in the still waters of the loch. When Jimmy had the shock of his life, because the face looking up at him was not his own. It was a face with long hair. He put his hands up. Yeah, he could feel long hair. It was a woman's face. He put his hands down, his body. Oh, yes, it was a woman's body. And so it was. Jimmy found he had been turned into a woman. He took the oars, he put them out, and he rowed and he rowed and he rowed in desperation. He rowed all night. It was only when the sun came up in the morning that he came to land, and it wasn't land he had ever seen before. There on the hillside, he could see a small farmhouse. And as Jimmy stepped out of the boat, the door of the farmhouse opened and the young farmer stepped out. The young farmer, who looked down at the boat looked at the young woman before him. Oh, yes. And that is how it happened. The two fell in love. They fell in love. They got married. Of course, Jimmy didn't say anything about being a man beforehand. You wouldn't, would you? People think you were mad. But well, they were married and happy. The farmer, he was a good husband. And Jimmy, he was she was a good wife. The children came, a boy and a girl. They were happy. The years went by until one afternoon the farmer said, "Hey, missus, got a surprise for you tonight. We're going to have a ceilidh this evening." "A ceilidh? Yep, I've got a barrel of whiskey here. There's another barrel of whiskey in the boat. Oh, we'll have a good time." And a good time they did have. All the neighbours were there and they were drinking the whiskey. They were telling the stories, drinking the whiskey, singing the songs, doing the dances. And halfway through the evening, the farmer, he was halfway through one of his best stories when suddenly something terrible happened with the whiskey. That barrel, it was empty. "Yep, it happens. It's happened to me often. That barrel was empty." "Ah," said the farmer, "don't worry, everyone. I got another barrel of whiskey in the boat. I'll go and get it." And Jimmy, she said, "Ah, you're in the middle of your story. I'll go and get it." And so Jimmy opened the door and ran down to the boat on the side of the loch under the full moon, just leaning in to pick up that barrel. Well, I don't know what it was. Perhaps it was the full moon, but it seemed in the darkness behind the barrel, was there something glistening, something shining? Jimmy looked over more, and you know, her foot must have slipped on the soft mud because she fell into the boat, fell in so hard, bang, she was out cold. And yes, her weight was enough to push that boat out onto the water. When she came to, oh, she could feel the bump. She wondered how big it was. She looked over. Indeed, the face looking up at her. The face of a young boy. Short hair. Huh? She began to feel down. Oh, that was all right. A boy again. He got the oars, put them out, began to row and row, and soon came back to land, stepped out, and there was the farmhouse on the other side. It ran up, opened the door, and the farmer said, "Hey, Jimmy, you've come back soon enough, but have you got a story to tell?" "Oh, give me a glass of whiskey. I've got a story to tell." Well, they gave Jimmy a glass of whiskey, and they sat him down, and he told the story that I have just told you. "Ah, Jimmy, that's the best story we've heard all night. Have a drop more." Aye. You see, Jimmy, he became a great storyteller. Although they do say two things about him. That was always his favourite tale. But they also say that Jimmy sometimes, on a summer's night, when the moon was full, you could see him walking by the side of the loch with tears in his eyes as he remembered the children he had left behind.
Oh, well, great story, Richard. So you got to go through all that to become a storyteller.
It's the whiskey that does it for us, you know.
Well, I won't ask what you've been through, so we'll leave it at that, huh? You know, when I'm listening to your stories here, Richard, they really got a theatrical feel to them. Have you ever done any acting in the theater?
Actually, no. The little bit of amateur acting I have occasionally done is very fraught for me. I am a hopeless actor. Main problem, I just cannot remember my lines. It's very, very difficult. And yet I've always liked being on stage. So it was wonderful when I did discover storytelling because, yeah, I don't have to learn anything. I just know the story. It's at the back of my mind. Right. And so just as I've never had any theatrical training, I've never had any training as a storyteller, but just getting up and doing it. But one tip which somebody gave me when I started all those years ago was this. It's an aphorism which helped me understand a lot. As I say, never had any training, but it gave me an insight into what was happening. And it said, the amateur tells the words, the professional tells the story, but the artist tells the listener.
Wow.
When I heard that, I thought, my word, yeah, that is what's happening on stage. That's the difference between perhaps just acting where you have a text and storytelling, where that fourth wall is not there. You are just telling the listener. And it made me realize there's something about the dynamic. It's subtly different when you're no longer telling the story, but telling the listener. And that helped me an awful lot. So no hopeless actor, but I do enjoy telling the listener.
You're going to stick with storytelling then?
Yeah. Hollywood, no, they keep asking, but I say no.
Okay. You'll put Hollywood on hold, okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, your next story, I guess, are you going to tell this Wounded Selkie story?
Well, I thought, if we've got time to tell that, it's a tale which I have long been telling for a variety of reasons, partly because it's from the Orkney Islands, again, just north of Scotland, and I set it on one of the islands where I have actually been myself. Sure. So it has a strong personal resonance for me. But it's, for me, a story of hate, a story of forgiveness, reconciliation. And we all know that we need tales like that to help us get over our, let's say, the weaker sides of our humanity.
Sure. Well, I heard this story once. I would love to hear it again.
It's a tale, as I say, from the Orkney Islands. And up there are the seals in the sea. You walk along the beach, they come and they look at you with their dark round eyes, beautiful animals, and you think how wonderful they are. Up there, they don't call them the seals, they call them the Selkie. And this is a tale of a man who hated the Selkie. And he hated the Selkie because he was a fisherman. Each day, he'd take his boat and row across the clear, cold waters, and he'd put down a net hanging from a float on the surface, and then he'd row on, put down another net and another and another. And at the end of the day, they'd row back and haul up those nets and see what he'd caught. And of course, usually he caught good fish, but sometimes the fish were bitten. Sometimes the nets themselves were ripped. Sometimes ripped so much he could not even repair them, just had to throw them overboard. And that is when he'd say, "Ah, the bloody Selkie." You see, he was a man who indeed hated the Selkie. Now, there was one place off the north tip of Westry, one of the small islands of the Orkneys, where generally he'd always caught good fish. But this summer, day after day, his nets had been ripped. The fish were bitten. He'd thrown away so many nets that summer. And then at last, one day, when he rowed out and the day was calm and the sun was shining, as it sometimes is, even in the Orkneys. And he said, "Yeah, today is the day for revenge." Hmm. And he let down an anchor and he made the boat fast to the anchor rope. Then he put down the net hanging there from the float on the surface. And then he took off his clothes and sat there with his knife by his side. And the boat rocked gently. Time went by, perhaps his eyes closed, but suddenly he could hear, poof, poof, the float was being pulled down.
He looked down through the clear, cold waters. He could see a grey shape turning and twisting against the net. Ah, the bloody Selkie! And with that knife between his teeth, he dived and he swam down deeper and deeper until he came to the Selkie, and he took his knife and he stabbed and he ripped. And he could see the dark red blood well out into the clear, cold waters. Now, the Selkie, with that knife stuck in its side, it twisted and turned so much that the knife was pulled from the fisherman's grasp. He saw it spinning slowly down to the bottom of the sea. Well, the fisherman could not go down and get the knife because he got no air left in his lungs. He had to get up to breathe. But as he swam up, he said, "Ha, I may have lost the knife, but that's one Selkie won't be troubling my nets again." But the next day, when he went back to haul up all the nets he'd put out, they were empty. Well, that can happen when you're fishing. But the next day, it was the same. And the day after, soon he realized he was under the curse of a Selkie. Soon he stopped bothering to even take his boat out. What was the point? Well, one day he was leaning on the harbour wall of that little town of Pirawal, looking out over the grey, cold waters, when he heard a voice behind him. "Hey, Jimmy!" He turned around. He saw a man, a stranger, with a hat pulled low over his face. "Been looking for you. Told you can help me. I need to get some Selkie skins." "Selkie skins? Kill a few Selkie? Oh, I'm the man for you." "Yeah. But I have to talk about the price." "Oh, price? Then in that case, you better come with me. I'll take you to my master." And the stranger led the fisherman out of the village and along the footpath high up over the cliff on the north tip of Westry. And when they came to the point where the footpath was on the very edge of the cliff, the stranger turned to the sea, put his hands to his mouth and called, "Oh, oh, oh." And the fisherman, looking out over the grey waters, saw those grey waters were no longer empty, for coming to the stranger's call with a Selkie, swimming to the call. And suddenly, the fisherman felt a hand on his shoulder, the stranger's hand pulling him over the edge. Together, they were falling down to the sea. And it was no longer a hand, for the stranger had turned into a Selkie, and it was the Selkie's jaws biting on the fisherman's shoulder and dragging him down, down, deeper and deeper under the waters they went, until the fisherman knew he had no more air in his lungs. He knew very soon he would have to open his mouth. He knew when he did, the blackness would cover his eyes. But when the fisherman opened his eyes, he found he was standing on the bed of the sea, the stranger beside him, a man again, a man who pointed to the great rock on the seabed, and in front of that rock lay the figure of a young man. Young man, his body grey with approaching death. Grey all except the long red wound running from his shoulder down to his groin. "That's my son lying there, dying.
And this is your knife. It is. It is. And you have brought me here for your revenge? Revenge? Revenge I could have. But revenge would not help my son. For only the hand that made the wound can heal the wound. Heal the wound? How can I heal the wound? Easy. Put out your hand and touch it. And the fisherman put out his hand. He put it on the top of the wound on the young man's shoulder. And as he drew it down, that cold, cold body, cold with approaching death. But the fisherman saw, yes, the wound was closing. The wound was healing. But as the fisherman drew his hand slowly further and deeper down the wound, why, the cold from that body, the cold came into the fisherman's hand, the fisherman's arm, the fisherman's shoulder. The cold came around the fisherman's heart, squeezing it so much he knew soon the pain would be so great that he'd fall to the ground and blackness would cover his eyes. But when the fisherman did open his eyes, he found he was no longer under the sea. He was on the land, and the small strip of beach under the high cliffs on the north tip of Westry. He was alive. He could still feel the pain, but he was alive. And he looked to his side, where he saw a pile of his old fishing nets, all beautifully repaired. And on those nets lay his knife. Oh, you can imagine. In later years, the fisherman, when he pulled those nets up, there was usually enough fish to eat. Sometimes, of course, the fish were bitten. Sometimes even the nets were ripped. But he'd only say, that's only the Selkie, and they need to live as well as I. And that is the end of my tale.
Wow. Well, Richard, that scene at the bottom of the sea, that's so poignant. The father looking there at his son dying, and the guy who almost killed his son has to heal his son.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Again, yeah. It's a tale for not just for today, but for all times. And it's
like you say, it was a tale of forgiveness. And
yes,
that one worked out well. It doesn't always work out well in the end, but that one did.
Yeah. And the alternative is to stay with hate, and that gets us ultimately nowhere.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, I hear you do encore stories sometimes, just little short ones, just to kind of top off the performance. You got one for us?
Yes. I'm mainly telling in the theatre to adults, so I often give a comic one here in Europe, or often a rather bawdy one, but very often I feel the need for a deep one as well. It's got to be short, and this one I've used so often, it's perhaps the oldest story I tell, arguably. It's connected with the African bush people as part of their creation myth. I heard it many years ago, and this is how my version has evolved. Right. Because if you go out into the still, quiet hour before the dawn, you know you'll find that the grass is wet with the dew. Now, many years ago, on the great African plain, the little rabbit, he stepped out into the field, and the still quiet hour before the dawn, the grass was wet. The rabbit wondered where the water had come from. and he heard the sound of crying. He looked up. It was the moon. The moon in the sky was crying, and the moon's tears were trickling down and making the grass wet. "Hey, moon! Moon, why are you crying?" "I am crying because I am not like man." "Not like man? Yeah, but what do you want to be like man for?" "Oh, I want to be like man because man never dies." "Never die? Of course man dies. Hey, come down here. Come down. I'll show you man dies." And so the moon stepped out of the sky, and the rabbit took the moon to a hut and pointed through the window, where on a bed lay an old man, the last breath rattling in his throat. "You see, look, look, man dies." "Oh no," said the moon. And the moon took the rabbit to another hut and pointed through the window on that other bed, where there lay a young woman, by her side a young man, and between them their newborn baby. "You see, they are two. They have each other, and because they have each other, there is always new birth. But I am alone in the sky, and at the end of my time, there will be no more moon."
Ah.
And with that, the moon stepped back up into the sky, still crying for that which he could not have, as he's crying today, as you will find if you step out into the fields in the still quiet hour before the dawn and find the grass wet with the moon's tears.
Ah, wow. You know, I'm not the sentimental type, Richard, but that was really touching.
It's a story I have told at weddings. I've told it at the funerals of both my parents as well.
Wow.
Surrounded by the grandchildren for their grandchildren and great-grandchildren. It's a story which indeed is for all seasons.
Yeah. Great funeral story. Yeah, that's very fitting. Well, you know, Richard, I know you're a crazy busy guy, so I really appreciate you taking the time to be on our program today. And before we let you go, I want to mention that you have a website, and it's called tellatale.eu, tale as in story, tellatale.eu. I guess that's for Europe.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about this website.
Well, it's just a website which has grown over the years and gives me great pleasure to put things up there. The main features about it is the video gallery, and I have over 130 tales now. I think all the tales which I've told today are on the video, in the video gallery. I try to put a new one up each month, and if people want to be alerted to when a new one goes up, there's a newsletter you can sign up for, which is also there for people to know when I'm coming to their part of the world with a performance or a workshop. But there's a lot on the website, especially for teachers of language as well. Something I used to be myself. A lot of material there.
Okay. Well, if you ever get to our part of the world, drop me a line. Maybe we'll get you to our live studio.
I am waiting for invitations from all over the world. So anyone who wants to ship me in that, I enjoy traveling for storytelling.
Sounds great. Okay, Richard, thanks again for being on our show, and good luck to you, and keep telling those stories.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me, Eric. It's been a great pleasure, and I would like to just close by saying, as I do on stage, that the stories you've heard, of course, all thousands and thousands of years old, yet today, because you have been here to listen to them. The stories have been alive. So I ask everyone who's listening, please keep the stories alive by telling them to others. You won't tell them in my way. You'll tell them in your way. But the stories are kept alive. Thank you, Eric, for doing your part in keeping our stories alive too.
And thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, that's our show for today, folks. I'd like to thank our special guest, Richard Martin, for all those great stories. And don't you dare move, because Charles Hightower is up next with a sweet mix of soul music on R&B Gold. This is Eric Keene, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after.
Ramona, come closer, shed softly your watery eyes. The pangs of your sadness will pass as your senses will rise. For the flowers of the city, though breath like it, death like some time. And there's no use in trying to deal with the dying, though I cannot explain that in lines. You crack country lips, I still wish to kiss, as to be by the strength of your skin. Your magnetic movement still captures the minutes I'm in. But it grieves my heart, love, to see you trying to be a part of a world that just don't exist. It's all just a dream, babe, a vacuum, a scheme, babe, that sucks you into feeling like this. I can see that your head has been twisted and fed with worthless foam from the mouth.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Graham Jordison of Lincoln, Nebraska, works as an organizer with Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign, helping communities push for the closure of local coal power plants. But last summer, he set out to explore some of those communities from a different vantage point, the seat of his kayak. Over 74 days, he paddled the length of the Missouri River. That's more than 2,000 miles, through seven states, and past 10 coal plants with tall, looming smokestacks.
It's eye-opening when you do see them and they're out in the middle of nowhere.
Along the way, he met with other activists to share his experiences and learn about their work. And the trip also gave him a chance to connect with local residents at restaurants, bars, and along the riverbank.
People come up to you and they ask you what you're doing out there and why you're doing it.
He says some people are fossil fuel workers and worry about how plant closures will affect their communities. So he valued the chance to talk with them, not as an activist, but as a fellow human being with shared concerns about people's lives.
It's just a reminder of how similar we all are, and I just have to take that to heart and continue to organize through that lens.
As he works for a clean energy future. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Life in Focus, or LIF, presents lively, diverse, and sometimes controversial topics. Life features interviews, commentaries, and discussions that stimulate conversations around contemporary issues in politics, education, economics, women's issues, health and safety, history, entertainment, music, art, spoken word, relationships, and everyday life. All with an Afrocentric flavor. Anil Williams, producer-host, has a no-nonsense cut-to-the-chase style that is provocative and simply refreshing. Life in Focus with Anil Williams, Monday afternoons, 3 to 4 p.m., here on 90.1 KPFT.
Hey, y'all, this is Susan, your host of Border Radio on Houston's community station, KPFT. Join us for Border Radio Saturday afternoon from 4 to 6, right after Deadbeat. Border Radio is your destination for music from your favorite independent artists and new artists on the rise. Mark your calendar, Border Radio Saturday afternoon from 4 to 6 on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM, FM HD1, and KPFT.